Attention listeners, we're excited to announce that AfterSight will be moving to our new office on March 26th. As we make this transition, our services will be down most of the day. We apologize for any inconvenience, but truly appreciate your understanding as we start this new chapter. Thank you for listening to AfterSight.
You're listening to an AINC original podcast. We believe you don't have to do life without a compass. Let us be your guide on this amazing journey. Welcome to Navigating Life with Vision Loss.
Hello, this is Kim Wardlow, your host for NLVL. We are into the holidays and our holiday series. We're also just a few days away from Colorado Gives Day. You still have a few days to pre-schedule a donation if you are so inclined. We would appreciate that at coloradogives.com, and then you can search for AfterSight or other organizations that you would like to donate to. And then Colorado Gives Day is December 10th, so next Tuesday. So think about that as you're looking at holiday experiences. It's always a great thing to be able to give to an organization that you really connect with. So looking at that. But I am here today with Deborah Erickson, who is the founder of The Blind Kitchen, and it's been a while. I know Deborah's been on the program before, but it's been a while. Deborah, it's so great to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I always look forward to this. It's always fun.
Well, that's great. So for those of you who aren't familiar, The Blind Kitchen has recipes, tools. Deborah, do you want to just describe briefly your site and what you do?
Sure. We're web-based only, and it's theblindkitchen.com, and we sell adaptive culinary tools that are very effective and adaptive for people who want to cook despite vision loss. We also have recipes that are free to access. We also have we have a blind kitchen library that has 12 different categories: dining out, cleaning, organizing, shopping, labeling, identifying, all kinds of different things that you need to do if you want to cook, and you need to find different ways to do it if you experience vision loss.
Yes, and frequently, not everyone, but I have had folks tell me, oh, I love to cook, but I've lost my vision and they're not sure how to do things safely, or they feel awkward in the kitchen trying to measure and things like that. Or maybe they feel okay about cooking, but their friends or family are thinking they can't do that any longer because they've lost vision, they're blind. But that's just not the case.
That is true. That it's definitely, and their fears are well intended, but they're not well placed, because people with vision loss can cook safely. We have the joke in the blind kitchen that if you get invited to someone's house and everybody's participating in putting the meal together, that you often get asked, would you like to toss a salad? Not to cut the stuff up that goes in it, but just to toss the salad, because that way you're not going to sue them if you cut off a hand or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah. it's just a misplaced well intention. If you have the right tools and you have the right information and strategy, you definitely can cook safely and independently with vision loss.
Yeah, it's really tools and learning the techniques, and I think folks might be surprised at how much of cooking isn't necessarily visual. It's other senses as well.
Sure. And that's whether you have vision loss or not. Of course, right. Those of us who cook with vision loss, we rely much more on our other senses than our vision if it's not available to us. But it definitely is smell and taste and touch and all those other things. And there are tools such as like a talking thermometer or a talking scale where we can get the information in an alternative way, not through our eyes, but often through our ears, we can get a lot of information.
Or even smell. If you're
I missed that one.
trying to tell if something is done, or hopefully, you know, you catch it before you're smelling something that's burnt.
That would be good. Well, sure. And cooking is based in science. It's time and temperature for the most part, and chemical reactions and all that. So once you understand, for example, if you put a piece of toast in the toaster, you can smell it before it goes in, you can touch it before it goes in, and it's soft to the touch, and the smell is very different than after you put it in and you put it down for a few minutes. And as those sugars start to reach 337 degrees, it's called caramelization, then you start to smell a nuttier, and it starts to dry the bread out, so it feels different and smells different. And if you accidentally overdo it, which we all do occasionally mm-hmm. when we're cooking, you'll the first thing you'll probably get is the smell, even before the fire alarm goes off or the smoke alarm. So you definitely want to, if I'm cooking something that has kind of a short cooking time, and it may not take that long to reach the point, like a pancake or something where it might burn, I stay nearby it, because I'm going to get the information through my nose before, and I want to be standing right there so I can stop the cooking process before it does reach the point where the sugars are burned.
Yeah, and there are tools. I know on your website you have a great video right now about 10 cooking tools to give for Christmas gifts for folks who enjoy cooking. And I think, you know, when you're looking for gifts for folks and they have a hobby or something they really enjoy, you're always trying to figure out, well, what's really a good present and not just something that might be gimmicky. You know, for cooking, sometimes you get things and it's like, this sounded good, but it doesn't really work that well. But the tools that you have on your list of 10 are really great tools and can help in cooking, like with boiling. You have a little disc to help with knowing if something is boiling.
Yeah, we call that the boil alert disc. And again, not made for blind or visually impaired people, but it's a little ceramic disc. And I won't go into the science of it. You can go onto the website. But basically, when water starts to boil, bubbles form and they go up through the water and escape as steam. When water hits 212 degrees, it has to do it. It's science. It's chemistry. So when those bubbles start to form, they start to form in the center bottom of the pan where that disc is laying. And so they had to get out from under it to do what their nature tells them to do. And when they do, it lifts that little ceramic disc just a little bit. And so if you're hearing it click hard and fast, that means your water's violently boiling. Or if you just want to simmer something, you may lower the temperature, the knob, or however you adjust your temperature to where it just goes click, click, click. And so blind people for centuries have been able to monitor and know if water's boiling or not without any vision, without this boil alert disc. But the reason you can't really do it from across the room. The boil alert disc allows you to walk away from the pan, because sometimes it's important to know how hard the water's boiling as right. when it stops boiling. If you don't hear anything, sometimes that's a warning note. So mm-hmm. why that was created was to prevent boil over. So if you're cooking like pasta or potatoes, they have a high starch content. So bubbles, when they form, there's starch in them. So they're hardier than just regular water bubbles without starch. And they start climbing on each other and climbing up the sides of the pan and over the edge. And it sounds terrible. And it's just a mess. So this second bonus of this boil alert disc, why it was invented, was to stop that from happening. And it does a pretty darn good job.
Yeah, there were also a couple of measuring tools that I thought were great as well. There's the ladle-shaped liquid measuring spoons, but then also that measured dispenser, like for olive oil or vinegar. I thought that was really helpful too.
Yeah, so you're talking, the second one you mentioned was the auto measure spout, and it is by far one of our best sellers. And what you do is you stick it in a bottle. It's about 3 inches tall, and it's made out of plastic, and it has stainless steel ball bearings inside of it. I don't understand how it works, but you put it on a bottle where it's tightly fitting, and then you turn of liquid, and it dispenses oils as well as like vinegars or waters. So whatever you might need, a tablespoon of liquid, You put the thing on the bottle, you tip the bottle upside down over the pan or the bowl where you are want it to go into, and you'll hear it dispense, you know, drip, 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 and then it stops automatically, even if it's still being held upside down. So if I want a second tablespoon of oil for that in that pan, I'm just going to put my bottle right side up again, and then I'm going to turn it upside down again, and again, I'll hear the drip, and I'll hear it stop. It's really nice because when you're cooking with vision loss, generally you're seeing with one hand and working with the other. That's an ideal situation. And this one is one of those where it doesn't take two hands to measure out that liquid. It just takes one hand, and the other hand can locate the pan that you want it to get into. Mm-hmm. Now, the second one you measured is a regular tablespoon, teaspoon, half a teaspoon, quarter teaspoon set. But in the blind kitchen, the measuring spoons are shaped more like ladles, and this is with the cups as well. But the handles face upwards towards the ceiling. So let's say you need that same tablespoon of olive oil, but you don't have an auto measure spout and you need to make sure that it's coming out. Or maybe you need a teaspoon of vanilla. Vanilla is very expensive right now, and you don't want to waste it. And that's hard to do with the traditional ways, using traditional tools, because you're pouring the vanilla, you're checking with your other finger, is it full? You're holding the spoon, pouring a little more vanilla, is it full? And usually you can't tell it's full until it spills. I mean, until it goes over. Most of us don't have enough, feeling in our fingers to know that. So with ours, you take you'll find it because you count the number of dots on it. It's tactilely marked, so you'll know what size you're getting. You put it inside the little pitcher we send with it, a little like 2 ounce spouted pitcher. And you set it in there, and now, because the pitcher's so small, the spoon is standing up by itself. Then you take the vanilla, and you pour it into the little pitcher until the spoon cavity is submerged. You don't want it coming out of the pitcher. You just want to submerge, make sure that spoon is under liquid. Then, if you go to pick it up, just like you would pick ladling soups, a lot easier if you use a ladle than a flat spoon. Same thing works for these liquids. You pick straight up. And if you don't hear anything drop and you bring it across to your target bowl and empty it, you're going to know you got the exact right amount because nothing dropped out and it was under liquid just, a few seconds ago. Mm-hmm. But now you have overflow in that little spouted pitcher. So we also send a special size funnel. And you can put that right back in the vanilla bottle or olive oil bottle. And you then direct the contents of that little pitcher into the funnel. You don't have to use a tiny hole that's the opening for the cap for the thing. And now you've got like a 3-inch target and you just empty it in. It goes in quickly. And so now you know for sure you have measured accurately and there's no waste. Those are really handy to have. Those are game changers if you're measuring liquids with vision loss.
Yeah, I thought those seemed great. And so, yes, definitely if you're interested in those top 10 tools, check out the Blind Kitchen website and that video, and those tools are all there. Do you have tips that maybe don't require specific tools but are just adaptive techniques that aren't necessarily reliant on a tool, but to help a person who's cooking with vision loss?
We have they're all over the website, but I'll give you the first strategy I do when I cook is I run a sink with a couple of inches of warm soapy water. Because if my fingers get messy while I'm working, or if I'm cutting up chicken and I go and I find my way over to where the sink is, and then I touch the water control and the water faucet and the soap bottle to wash my hands, now I've got to go back and decontaminate all of those places, right? Especially if it's a raw protein. But if I have a couple inches of soapy water, I can just use the back of my hands or my forearms to find where that sink is and just plunge them immediately. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a second. And now my hands are clean to touch the water controls so I can rinse them. So plus, I've also got a start on doing dishes. I can throw that funnel and that stuff in there. So I'm already starting to clean up as well. And I run only a little bit at a time because cooking with vision loss generally takes longer than it does without vision loss. At least that's been my experience, and I think most people's. And so the water can get kind of cold, and that's unpleasant to dip your fingers mm-hmm. into cold water. So you can just run a couple more inches of soapy water, in warm water in there. It revives the suds, makes it pleasant again, and you're on your way. And so the second tip I have is we sell something called towel clips, but you don't need to have towel clips. You can take a safety pin and pin a towel, dish towel, to your apron, or even if you want to do it to your clothing, however you want to do it. And that way, that dishcloth is going to travel with you as you do your work. Because I can't tell you many times I have very carefully and thoughtfully put a towel down on the counter so that I'd know where it would be when I come to get it. And 99 times out of 100, I find it as I'm walking over towards it because it's fallen onto the floor somehow. Gravity reached up the floor. The floor people reached up and pulled it down. So that's a real handy one. The nice thing about the towel clips, though, is after it gets wet or whatever, you don't have to take the towel clip off. You can just open the alligator stainless steel jaws and then just change it out and change it in real easy. Safety pin, you'd have to do a little bit more, but still, it's a great tip.
Yeah, that is great. Maybe it would be helpful to give just an example of, as we're talking about tips of, and as you said, it might take a little bit longer to cook, so you'd want to build that in if you're prepared, especially if you're preparing a big holiday meal. But let's just take an example of what's a holiday staple in a lot of homes, not everywhere, but in many homes, is the mashed potato. And that might be a basic to use as an example for folks of how they can use various techniques and tools to make their holiday dinner.
Yeah, so that's a good choice, actually, because most of us already know how to make mashed potatoes. But how can you cut them up now if you have vision loss with safely? Mm-hmm. And how can you drain the potatoes after you cook them safely? So I'll go through the process and tools and tips that would help making just basic mashed potatoes. So the first thing I do is I have my workspace prepared, and I have a work tray, which is basically a cafeteria tray, so that if I do have any spills or anything like that, it's going to be held into that area by that work tray with its slightly raised edges. So that's a really good tip there, too. And so let's say we'll start with peeling the potatoes. That's usually the first. So we have a peeler. It has two rings on the back side, two places for two of your fingers to go into. It's not on a stick. It's on like a 3x3 inch square, and the blade faces out. So now the rings are around the blade, the palm peeler's in the palm of my hand, and it's being held in place by those ring fingers that come out of the back of it. And so now my fingers can be very near the action of where the peeling's happening, so I can touch them when I'm ready to bring my fingers around to the front. I can do that to inspect what I'm doing, but it's totally in my control to have the fingers come out of the way, out of the back while I'm doing the peeling. It's very simple to control. The other thing we have is a cut glove, and I would encourage everyone to get one. They're not very expensive, and they're cut resistant, so that if I am peeling, so the fingers behind the peeler or the fingers holding a knife are safe because they're trapped behind the blade. It's the hand holding the food that's in danger.
Right.
So when I'm peeling, I put on this cut-resistant glove. It's quite thin. You can't read Braille through it or anything like that, but it's quite thin. And what's going to happen if I'm peeling and all of it, or cutting, and all of a sudden I feel pressure on that hand holding that food when I don't expect to, I'm just going to stop. If I had been cutting like a potato, and by the time my brain feels the pressure, gets the information, I'm already cut. It's too late at that point. So this gives you that a layer of protection that allows you to just stop. And the other place that comes in is if you're doing latkes or something like that in grating. Plenty of people leave. Box graters are weird. They're angled. They have lots and lots of different kinds of blades. So I would never grate anything without wearing a cut glove. So that cut glove also works the same for a knife when you go to cut up the potatoes. But there's another tool I want to tell you about. It's called a shark, and it's just a little, kind of shaped like a teaspoon, but it's got little jagged teeth around the edges of the teaspoon. Not enough to cut your fingers, but it's enough that if you're trying to get around a eye sprout on your potato or a soft spot, instead of using a paring knife, which can be quite dangerous, even if you can see, because you're angling it and all of a sudden it clears it or it takes out more than you want it to. This just takes out like a little divot of your potato. And so that's a nice tool to have. So let's say you've cut up the potatoes now and you're ready to put them into the water that you're going to boil. So I'm going to put a boil alert disc in the bottom of that water. But I'm going to use a locking lid pan. So what a locking lid pan does is we sell them in 5-quart and 8-quart, but they are indispensable. They have a creatively designed lid that you can actually use the handles of the pan to lock the lid onto it. Because if I'm trying to make potatoes, a pasta or something like that, and I have to carry that pot over to the sink where my colander is in the sink, it's going to be an educated guess at best, because I can't carry that pan with one hand and check what's going on with the other. It's too heavy. With this locking lid pan, you check the potatoes are done. Okay, they're done. Put the lid on it. Turn the handles 180 degrees, and you'll figure out how to use it. And then the lid actually goes about an inch into the pan. It sits on top of the pan, but then there's a rim that goes about an inch down, and it has holes in it. So I can actually pour it without worrying about the lid coming off, and the food's going to stay in the pan. It is a game changer. And it's got a ceramic nonstick surface coating, so I can actually put my hand mixer into that and use it. The nonstick surface won't be damaged. So the other thing that now I've got the potatoes drained, and now I'm ready to add butter and cream, or however your family recipe goes. People have different ways. We have something called a butter slicer that allows you in one swipe to cut through a stick of butter and cut it into 12 equal pats. They're about 2 teaspoons each. So I can pre-cut all the butter I want and have it in the refrigerator. And so when I go to make these potatoes, instead of grabbing a knife, you know, in the butter plate and trying to figure it out, I can just grab 2 pats of butter to start out with, taste it. Is it buttery enough? Heck no. I'm going to get 2 more. And I can just, and we recommend a lot of butter. But that's...
Yeah, I was going to say 2 pats definitely are not enough.
No. 2 sticks we're talking here. I'm just kidding. But that's another really handy tool for any time you're doing any cooking, that you don't have to get that knife out. You can just grab, I do a pound at a time, and I use it all week long as I'm cooking. So now we've got the potatoes mashed and all that. So now you're good to go with your mashed potatoes. And so those are the tools we used. You can use your own recipe for sure, but you have been able to do things that you used to do confidently and safely. And the outcome's going to be the same. You can see those are going to be good mashed potatoes.
Well, and it just would make the whole process more enjoyable, not to be worried, well, am I going to have something spill and go all over my counter or something, knowing that it's contained, and just all those different things can really be helpful.
Yeah. So one thing I want to say is, because it's the holidays, a lot of people lose their vision due to age-related conditions like macular degeneration or glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy. And so they often, part of their identity, that they were the griller or they were the cook of the family, especially around holidays and, you know, big meals. And once they lose their vision, they're probably not going to go to voc rehab to gain skills with technology and stuff. It's time to retire. They're supposed to be enjoying their lives. But that's a part of their identity, a huge part that is now lost. And with tools and tips like this, you can once again be the mashed potato maker or the pie maker or the turkey maker or the stuffing maker, whatever you were known for and whatever you loved cooking to provide a love language for the people you love, you can do it again. You just have to figure out different ways.
Yeah, and that's so key for individuals to be able to keep doing the things that they really love and not feel like they're having to sacrifice those pieces of their lives.
That is so true.
What about somebody who was the pie maker? I think, you know, I have the friends and family members of like, oh, they're going to bring the pie. And it won't be, you know, the one from the freezer section at the grocery store. It will be a homemade pie. Are there tips? I mean, that's a more complicated dish to make. And of course, depending what type of pie you're making.
Sure. It is more complicated. Making a homemade pie crust, what a gift to bring to someone's home, because it's so different. And the reason they're different is the pie crust you buy in the store that are rolled up or frozen or whatever, they're made with shortening, because shortening is less expensive than butter. And they're out to make the money. I'm not saying I use them sometimes, don't get me wrong. But your homemade ones are going to be made with butter and maybe a combination of butter and shortening. But they're going to just be so much flakier and so much better. So we have a couple of things. We actually have a pie maker collection, but I'll go over the things that are more for sight loss that to make the biggest impact. And one is, I talked about the work trays that we have I use them as cutting boards. Well, this one is an extra large work tray. We call it our dough and pastry tray, and it's about 18 inches deep and about 24 inches wide. So even when I could see, and I would sprinkle flour on the counter, you know, to roll out my dough with my rolling pin, it would get all over the place. And not because I was messy, but because flour is so light and you're making movements. And so that error is causing stuff to move around. With this dough work tray, it is so wide, and it's got the slope sides. You can use a rolling pin on it, and you can also, and it'll help contain the flour to the inside of it. They're really nice for different applications, different things that you're cooking too that are larger. So that's a big thing. We have pie dough bags, which are bags that are two thick plastic circles that are attached by a zipper. And so you put the dough inside it. They're a certain size. You roll up the zipper. So now that dough is trapped inside these two kind of like dinner plates is basically what it looks like. And then you roll out the dough. It can't get out past the zipper. So you know you're going to have a circle. You can work with it until it forms a circle. And then the rolling pin we have is an adjustable one where it's got four wheels on each side. They're all different. They're different sizes. So if I want a thicker pie dough, like maybe for a pizza or something like that, I will use the largest wheels. And if I want a thinner one, like let's say for a crepe or not a crepe, like a wonton wrapper, then I'm going to use the smallest one, and that's going to lower the height of the rolling pin as I go over the dough to a much, much lower. So it allows for consistency without sight. There's another tool called a bake under the pie server. And basically you put it in the pie pan, and then you put the lower crust over the pie, the bake under the pie maker. So once your pie is made, whether it's a one crust pie or a two crust pie, that thing is baked underneath it, and you can find it. It's very easy to find with your fingers on the edge. And in fact, people with vision can't see through pies either. And
that's true.
And this was made so that you can just take the tip of your knife and feel where the edges of that stainless steel, wedge that's underneath it. It'll cut a 9-inch pan into six equal pieces, but you're just cutting the first one out. And if you do it correctly, which you will, you're going to lift straight up and that pie is going to be right there. No more trying to twist and turn and get underneath. It's just going to be cut all the way. So you can just lift straight up and get that first piece out. And then we have a wheel that we called our pie marker and divider that you can put on top. It fits beautifully on a 9-inch pie plate. And it's six wedges that are already formed. It doesn't cut through the pie. I wish it did, but it doesn't. But it gives you a guide to make sure that your pieces are going to be even. You just
right.
It's a really nice thing. And just a second use for that is for cutting round pizzas into nice sections.
Oh, yeah.
That can be tough. So that it can also be a pizza guide. So one more thing I'd like to mention for homemade pies would be the our egg separator. What's so adaptive about an egg separator? This one is because it first of all, it does a beautiful job keeping the yolk away. Not all egg separators do, but it does a beautiful job. But it's got a little hook for a handle. It's not a long, most of them suspend across a bowl and have a long handle on one side and maybe like two grabbers on the other side.
Right.
This one hooks right directly to the bowl. There's nothing suspended across the bowl. So when I'm cracking an egg, I'm going to be using I'm going to have one half of the shell in each hand, sort of, you know, as after I crack it. And now I've got to find the bowl and the egg separator. So I can just use my pinkies to find it, and I'm not going to accidentally knock it off, which I used to do all the time. So it actually adheres to the side of a bowl. It's really cool. And then there are all kinds of tools, like an apple corer. I'm sure most people have used one where you peel the apple and then you push down. It's again shaped like a wheel, but it has a hole in the middle so it can take the core out. You want to stick it straight down. And ours has 12 sections, which are the perfect size for an apple pie. So yeah, so there's different tools that we have that can help with other parts of the pie, whether it be sweet or savory or a single crust. Yeah, but the pie maker stuff is quite adaptive and quite extensive.
Well, that's great information. I know a pie at the holidays, whatever type people like, pumpkin, pecan, chocolate cream, whatever people like.
You're making
like,
me hungry. Stop.
Often the pies are big at the holiday time. What about, as we talked about earlier, it can take a little bit longer, perhaps, if you're cooking without vision. And maybe you've been, you know, doing things, you're feeling pretty good about your skills, and you want to be the host, you want to have people over. Do you have tips on processes and things you can do so that it makes things less stressful when people are arriving?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot, and there is information on the website that you can read, but I'll give you a couple of really good tips. Number one, clean the day before. Do not try and cook and clean the same day. You'll be lucky to get the kitchen cleaned in time when you're trying to do an elaborate meal. The other thing you should do the day before is set the table and with all your glassware and all your silverware and have your serving dishes and serving tools in place so that you're not running to the above the refrigerator to get your special bowl that you use for mashed potatoes and now you've got to rinse it because it's been in there since last year. You'll right. have all that taken care of and it'll make for a much more relaxed day. So what I call it is begin with the end in mind. Have a plan. Yeah.
That's a great idea. And you can delegate tasks to people, too, when they arrive.
Everybody wants to help. I mean, there's so much joy and camaraderie in the kitchen. That's the most popular room during a holiday gathering. And give people meaningful jobs. Don't have them just toss the salad.
Right.
and try and think those out ahead of time, what you'd need help with. Do you need someone to make the gravy because you'll be busy carving the turkey or, you know, whatever form that takes? You know what you like to do. And that's the other secret is delegate what you don't like to do and have someone else do it.
Or if you have young children in your family that are or friends that are coming, think about things if they want to help, things that they could do, too.
Sure. Young children can grate cheese. They could wear one of those cut gloves. They sell them an extra small. So young children could use those safely as well. So there are definitely meaningful tasks that children can take place. The other thing they can do is we have a 1 ounce portion scoop, which is about makes balls about the size of a golf ball. So it's good for meatballs and it's good for also cookies. And a child could do that. Scoop up the cookie dough, flatten it into the portion scoop, use the lever to get out in their hand and roll it up in a ball and put it off to the side. No, nobody gets hurt if a cookie ball is a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, but that tool helps keep it within a reasonable amount for a consistent cooking time.
Yeah. I know lots of people, especially if they are cooks, have their favorite go-to dishes or traditional dishes that they have at the holidays. What are some dishes you tend to go to during the holiday time?
I'm from Indiana, so I'm pretty traditional, I think, and I'm one of 12 children, so my mother cooked a lot of food for the holidays. So I think I'm pretty traditional. It was turkey, gravy, cranberry sauce, green bean casserole. It's the only recipe I use canned green beans for. I hate it, but I've made it fresh. In fact, I have a gourmet I have both versions of the green bean casserole, homemade, and also, the original with the cream of mushroom soup. Right. And I like it with the cream of mushroom soup too. It's a traditional thing. And then pumpkin pie. Yeah, those are the kind. Oh, and I like making carrots with browned butter and almonds on it. That's not one my mother did, but that's a really good go-to. So I think I'm pretty traditional in that. And another recipe I'm developing right now that we're going to put on the website is, I learned of this tradition in the South that they eat black-eyed peas for good luck. That they refer to them as coins. And I am going to put that recipe on the website in time for New Year, because I'm so looking forward to, because it's so simple, but you could really doctor it up and make it really savory and really good. I'm looking forward to it.
That sounds really good. Any other New Year's types of treats or dishes that you like to put out?
Champagne. That's always a good one. Yeah. You can make mimosas or use cranberry juice or just use the apple sparkling stuff. I think having things, that are traditional is always a good thing. We didn't have a routine around New Year's Day when I was growing up. And even not now as adult, I think this black-eyed peas are going to be my new New Year's ritual.
Well, and you can always do that. You can always start a new tradition.
Mm-hmm. Sure, especially if it's going to bring me good luck.
There you go, for the new year. Well, Deborah, do you have any last tips or words of encouragement for our listeners who are getting ready to cook their holiday meals?
I just know what it's like to lose your vision after you've had it. And I know the fear, and believe me, I felt it. When I went to the Oregon Commission for the Blind to take cooking classes, I remember telling my cooking instructor, she asked me to do something, and I was completely blindfolded because I had more vision than I do this time. And I told her, you've got to stop. Just stop. I need to think. And literally, it's fear, flee or what is it? Face it or flee, I can't.
No, fight or flight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was in that moment and I knew I wasn't going to leave, but I also knew that I had to stop and think. And so nobody's going to die if a pancake burns so I would encourage you, this is a skill and it's something you need to practice to get your confidence up and to learn how does your kitchen work. Different pans have different thicknesses. Are you on a gas stove? Are you on a glass top stove? That can make a big difference in how things go, but you've got to learn your stuff. And speaking of which, one of the biggest questions I get asked in presentations is, especially on a glass top stove, how do I know if my pan is centered? And so there's a really good video tutorial on theblindkitchen.com that breaks that down into manageable pieces. I think it's like 12 or 13 minutes. But if you're nervous about cooking on your type of stovetop, that's a really good video to watch to help you learn how you can master that comfortably and confidently.
That's a great tip. I hadn't thought about that, but that is really important. You don't want half your pan to be off a burner.
No, not good.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for sharing all this information and advice with us. Food is such a big part of our holidays, no matter what year-end holiday, New Year's holiday, you're celebrating, food tends to be a really important part of that. So, and we all want that to be fun and enjoyable and be able to enjoy the time we have with friends and family and not be all stressed out about the food and about the cooking, but have it be fun. So thank you for helping us do that.
Thank you for helping me spread the word. I really appreciate it.
Sure. And do go to theblindkitchen.com if you want to get more information, see some of the instructional or hear some of the instructional videos. Everything is very well explained, and tools and things are there as well. So it's a great resource. So we hope you feel inspired to do some holiday cooking this year and be confident in that. Have a great holiday season, and we will see you on the next show in this holiday series. We hope it's helped you to navigate your life with vision loss.